Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today. The problem of sin is the topic of today's show with your host, Pastor John Ehlers.
Hello and thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK. My name is John Ehlers and I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent. If you'd like to listen to any previous episodes of the Lutheran Inquisitor, please go to our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Click the podcast button and have a look. Or if you'd like to make a comment about this or any of our programs, please send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. On today's episode of the Lutheran Inquisitor, we are very excited to welcome Dr. Joel Heck. Dr. Heck is professor of theology, specializing in the Old Testament, at Concordia University in Austin, Texas. Dr. Heck is currently on sabbatical, staying at Westfield House in Cambridge, researching British author and theologian C.S. Lewis. Dr. Heck, we'd like to welcome you to Lutheran Radio UK.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, because you're doing your research on C.S. Lewis, let's spend a little time talking about him. Could you give us perhaps a biographical background of C.S. Lewis, who he was, what he did, and why it's so important?
Well, perhaps I should start where I am in Cambridge. The last 9 years of his life, he was a fellow at Magdalen College, Cambridge. That would be the years 1955 to 1963. So he died in 1963 on the very same day that U.S. President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. But to go back to the beginning, he was born almost 65 years before that in 1898 to a father who was a solicitor and mother who was a college graduate in math and logic. Grew up with an older brother by the name of Warren and became an atheist at about the age of 14, but began a long journey, a 15-year journey back to the Christian faith, starting in 1916 and culminating in 1931. He became a theist in 1929, believed in God, started attending chapel, and then became a Christian in 1931, and he recounts the story of his conversion in those years up to his conversion in his autobiography, a book called Surprised by Joy. Prior to becoming a Christian, he became a fellow at Magdalen College, Oxford, which means he was a fellow at both Magdalens, a tutor, primarily a tutor in Oxford, and then a fellow not responsible for tutorials in Cambridge. He was at Oxford from 1925 to 1954, and then he taught at Cambridge from 1955 to 1963 while still living in Oxford. And he became known for a wide variety of writings. The three major pieces of writing that he's known for are his Chronicles of Narnia, that were published between 1950 and 1956, one each year, a total of seven. And your listeners may especially be familiar with, if they are familiar with anything of Lewis, they may know his first book in that series, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is now a film through Walden Media. And then the second thing he is known for is his BBC talks that later became the book Mere Christianity. And the third thing would be his imaginative fiction known as the Screwtape Letters, which are 31 separate letters allegedly from an experienced demon to a younger demon on the art of temptation. So those are the three major pieces of written work that he's known for. But he wrote something like 200 poems, probably in the vicinity of 30,000 personal letters, a couple dozen more books, plus many dozens of essays and talks, even a couple of sermons that he wrote and published and delivered over the course of his 40-year academic career, nearly 40-year academic career. So that's a quick overview of the life of C.S. Lewis.
Can I take you back just to a couple of things you've mentioned? You mentioned that he became an atheist when he was roughly 16 years old.
Yes.
Can we point to any reasons why that was the case? And had he been a practicing Christian before that time?
He grew up in an Anglican home in Belfast, Northern Ireland. And we don't know, actually this would be an interesting topic for someone to research, but he lost his mother to cancer in 1908 when he was 9 years of age, became an atheist around 1914, and in various places he talks about his intellectual difficulties with the problem of suffering, and so putting two and two together, I conclude that he had real concerns about the death of his mother and God not responding to his prayers. In fact, later on, after he had begun his journey back to the Christian faith, which started, as I said, in 1916 when he read a book by George MacDonald, in 1921 he wrote a letter to a friend, and I have a quotation right in front of me. He says to this friend in this letter, "The trouble about God is that he is like a person who never acknowledges your letters, and so in time you come to the conclusion either that he does not exist or that you have got his address wrong." So I'm guessing that his prayers to God for the healing of his mother would be successful, and he does talk about this a little bit in his biography, and they were not successful, so he came to the conclusion painfully that there must not be a God and decided that atheism was the better way to go at that point in his life.
So then how did he come to the conclusion that really he had the right address and God really was there?
Well, the thing that started him moving toward Christianity was reading a piece of imaginative fiction called Fantastes, which is a Latin word that means imagination. So George MacDonald, who is the most influential writer in C.S. Lewis's life, wrote that book about a parallel world to the world in which we live, much like the Chronicles of Narnia became later on, with Narnia being a parallel world to England. But then over the course of the next 15 years, he started reading many authors, people like G.K. Chesterton and George Herbert and John Milton, and he was attracted by their writings, and he came to the odd conclusion, or at least he thought it odd, that all of the really effective writers were the ones that had this Christianity in common, and the ones that seemed kind of thin were the atheists. And he noticed that, and it seems like God put a lot of Christian people in his path, and he was influenced by them. He met J.R. Tolkien, and then in the 1920s, actually met Tolkien in 1926. But early in the 1920s, he adopted a philosophy known as realism, which is an approach to life without God, but based upon a sense experience, immediate experience, sort of a materialistic philosophy. Came to see that as inadequate for understanding the existence of beauty and truth and honor and chivalry and so on. And he shifted from realism to idealism, which is another philosophical system that, as I understand it, and I'm no philosopher, but idealism understands that there are universal ideas outside of human experience, almost like Plato argues in his teaching on forms that exist behind the objects of our sense experience. But idealism has the convenient characteristic of believing in these universals without having the existence of God as part of that philosophy. Then he began to be challenged by some other things when an atheist philosopher from his own college had just read one of the Gospels, and though an atheist, he said to Lewis, "Rum thing, it almost looks as if it had happened once." And he is referring to the idea of God dying and rising. And Lewis himself had been attracted to the idea of a dying and rising God in a lot of pagan mythologies. And he was shocked by, this is Harry Weldon, or T.D. Weldon, for those that may have some sort of familiarity with Magdalen College, Oxford. But Weldon, his admission was very earth-shattering for Lewis, and he decided he needed to go back and read the Gospels, which he did. And then a few years later, he had a conversation with J.R.R. Tolkien and Hugo Dyson, who was a Shakespeare scholar from the University of Reading. Tolkien at that time was at Oxford University, and they convinced him that myth had the power to convey truth, whereas Lewis himself had once described myth as lies breathed through silver. And so Tolkien in particular had an impact upon him, how mythology, such as we become familiar with in The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien's own mythology, that there's powerful truth that can be conveyed in that particular mythical way. And so Lewis began to change his tune. And then he started to think about the myths in pagan religions, the dying and rising god, Dionysius and Baal and Bacchus and the like, and compared them to the biblical story of a dying and rising god, and finally came to the conclusion that the Christian story was like a myth, just like the others, except that this one seems to have happened. So he called the death and resurrection of Christ a true myth. And so in 1931, while riding in the sidecar of his brother's motorcycle to the Whipsnade Zoo, just northeast of Oxford, Lewis said he became a Christian, that starting out on that hour-long ride, he did not believe that Christ was the Son of God, and when he got to the zoo, he did believe that Christ was the Son of God. So he doesn't know he doesn't spell out for us in any of his writings exactly how that happens, but he does say that it happened during that motorcycle trip.
And you mentioned Tolkien and Dyson. Now, as I understand it, there's a very famous group of literary folks from that area who would regularly get together and meet and discuss their works with one another. And I understand that played a very important part in the shaping of Lewis and his Christian faith?
Oh, yes. The Inklings you are referring to, who were all Christian men with literary interests who were writing at the time, and they would gather together at the Eagle and Child in Oxford for fellowship, for conversation, and to read books that they were in the process of writing at the time. Most of The Lord of the Rings and its prequel, The Hobbit, were read to the Inklings. Lewis read much of his work, from The Problem of Pain to the early BBC broadcast that became Mere Christianity, to the Chronicles of Narnia and many other things, to that same group. And then these writers would get critique from a wide variety of people, some literary. One was a medical doctor, the Lewis family physician, and other people that attended from time to time, one of the historians at Magdalen College. So they had a wide range of scholars who understood ideas, knew how to communicate them, were good writers, and so C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien would both get some very effective and penetrating critique and able to make revisions based upon the things that were told them at the meetings of the Inklings.
And as I understand it, as Lewis read the Narnia Chronicles to Tolkien, he wasn't all that impressed.
No, Tolkien did not like the Chronicles of Narnia. Tolkien, for those who are familiar with him, Tolkien was a purist. He was a brilliant man, able to create languages that made sense grammatically, and he also created a history and a mythology for Middle Earth that eventually resulted in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. And everything within his world was consistent. C.S. Lewis has Father Christmas, or Santa Claus, as we call him in the States, naiads and dryads, tree spirits and river spirits. He would have fauns and satyrs and talking animals and all kinds of creatures from various mythologies, all wrapped up in his Chronicles of Narnia. And Tolkien said it just wouldn't do. He didn't believe that you should write that way. But on the other hand, Tolkien bought those books for his grandchildren later on, so even though he didn't like them personally, he recognized that others did, and so he thought it was good reading for some people, even his own grandchildren.
With regard to the Narnia Chronicles, as you said, most of our listeners will, if they haven't read the books, perhaps seen the movie. Can you go into a little bit of background of why Lewis chose this imaginary world and its Christian background, which is some would say even quite a bit under the surface of the tales.
Yes. So, well, first of all, Lewis says in one of his very, very short essays that his stories of Narnia began with seeing pictures in his mind, and he had a picture in his mind of a fawn carrying parcels in a snowy wood. And one day he decided to make a story out of it, and he started to write The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And then he says, after he got writing, Aslan came bounding into the story and pulled the rest of the series along with him. So it's almost as though Narnia happened to him rather than he invented Narnia. And in fact, he didn't have the idea of conveying profound Christian theology in the Chronicles of Narnia at the start. He just wanted to write a good story. And to a certain extent, Narnia happened to him, not just him happening to Narnia. But one of the experiences that ended up being incorporated into the Chronicles of Narnia, particularly the first one, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, was World War II, when he and his brother and others living at their home in Oxford called the Kilns were able to house children who had been evacuated from London due to the bombing that was going on in London. And those children stayed at the Kilns, which is a fairly good-sized home, not huge. But the memory of those children living at the Kilns shows up in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as one of the starting points for that story, when four children from London stay at an old professor's home in the country and have different experiences, and they enter a magic world called Narnia through a wardrobe in a spare room, and so that gets incorporated into it, and that's part of the background to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Even when he was writing the third book in the series, he didn't have a series of seven in his mind, but it ended up that way. He writes in one of his letters that when he wrote the first book, he didn't have a series planned, or the second or the third. But by the fourth book, he probably has a series in mind as Englishman, and I think he's from Oxford. Now, Michael Ward has demonstrated in a couple of his books, one called Planet Narnia, which argues that the medieval cosmology of seven planets is the pattern for the seven Chronicles of Narnia, and that each one of the planets shows up in somewhat hidden form in each of the seven Chronicles of Narnia. But because there are only seven planets in the medieval mindset, there were only going to be seven books for the Chronicles of Narnia, and he did stop the series after seven books. So that seems after we're halfway through the series to have been part of the inspiration for fixing on the number of seven. Michael Ward later on wrote a more popular version of his dissertation called the I believe it's the Narnia Code, where he describes this idea in a much less scholarly version.
Good.
So that's a good deal of the inspiration for the Chronicles of Narnia.
And as you said, maybe not writing them with an overtly Christian message behind them, but you mentioned mere Christianity. Now, that has certainly a pointed message to it. Can you give us a bit of the background about mere Christianity? You said Yes. It came from BBC programs.
Well, Lewis had written a book about suffering called The Problem of Pain that was published in 1940. And that book was noticed by the director of religious broadcasting for the BBC, a guy by the name of Dr. James Welch. And the BBC was looking for intelligent voices who could broadcast over the BBC during World War II, in particular, people who would help to raise the morale of the nation. So the BBC contacted C.S. Lewis about doing a series of talks, which he agreed to do in spite of the fact that he did not like radio. Later on, as television comes on the scene, he does not like television, but he realized that through the radio he'd be able to reach people who would never think of reading his books. So he accepted the invitation, and Welch engaged Lewis for four talks on Wednesday evenings in August of 1941. And it was a series of talks entitled Right and Wrong, A Clue to the Meaning of the Universe. And in that series, he did what we would call pre-evangelism. He tried to awaken a sense of right and wrong in the consciences of the hearers and help them to understand that there is a God, that there are objective standards of right and wrong, and that we need to get to know him. Well, his series was very, very popular. His voice was a great voice for the radio, a rich baritone voice, and an intelligent voice that's able to talk about profound ideas in clear, simple language that any individual can understand. And so before the first series was over, he was asked to do a second series, and he did that one on what Christians believe. That's actually the subtitle for part two of Mere Christianity. So that the book consists of four subsections, each of which are four series of talks over the BBC. So during the third series, he's invited, or during the second series, he's invited to do a third series and then a fourth series. And eventually, all of these are published separately until in 1952, so 8 years after the last BBC talk is given, all of the talks are combined into a single volume. A few additional chapters are added that were never broadcast over the BBC, but in order to complete the book, and they are published in 1952 then under the title Mere Christianity.
And you think because it was originally a radio broadcast, that's why it makes it so easy to read, because it just really flows wonderfully, and it really hits home very, very effectively.
Yes. Well, Lewis was a person who believed that you needed to write both for the eye and the ear. And he would typically speak aloud the words he was writing while he's writing them to see how it sounded in the ear, not just how it looked on the printed page. And that helped him to be more effective in his writing. But it's also true that he simply had a brilliant mind. He was able to take difficult concepts and present them in clear fashion. And the fact that he was doing this over the radio for a wide audience, it's a little bit like a preacher who recognizes that in his congregation he's going to have people with widely varied backgrounds, with different educational levels, different ages, different occupations. And if he preaches at a level that's too complicated and too difficult for some of the people, he's going to lose them. So a preacher has to be doing something of a broadcast in a sermon rather than a technical theological dissertation. So his radio broadcasts were listened to in pubs all across England by educated people and by lorry drivers and all kinds of other people who appreciated his ability to talk about difficult subjects in simple, not simplistic, but simple yet profound language.
And you mentioned another book, The Screwtape Letters, which I think embodies that perfectly. It is profound almost to the extreme, but it is so simple that anybody can follow it. Can you tell us a bit more about The Screwtape Letters, how it got its name, and its importance within the life of the church even today?
Oh, yes. I described The Screwtape Letters earlier as letters imagined to be from a senior devil to a junior devil on the art of temptation. They are originally serialized in The Guardian, a weekly publication of the Church of England, starting in February of 1941. And then one of the local publishers saw what was being published, had heard the name Lewis, and decided to see about purchasing the rights to publish all of the letters in a book. And the book came out in 1942, and the first edition of 2,000 copies was sold out before publication. The book was reprinted again and again half a dozen times in that first year, and to date has sold millions, at least 2 million, probably a lot more than that. But Lewis got the idea for the Screwtape Letters while he was in church. In 1940, his brother Warren, his older brother, who worked for the Royal Army Service Corps, which is the supply side of the Royal Army, was on the field in France helping the Allies against Nazi Germany. And so Jack wrote him, Jack was his nickname, by the way, wrote him this letter about the idea he got during a sermon about this senior devil writing to a junior devil whose name is Wormwood. Well, the senior devil is named Screwtape. And Lewis had learned something about assigning names to characters from some of the other imaginative fiction he had read, H.G. Wells, particular David Lindsay, a book called The Voyage to Arcturus, and other imaginative writers, including George MacDonald and Charles Williams. And so Screwtape seemed to be a good name to apply to a demon. Wormwood has a little bit of that negative connotation to it. And so the letters are named after this senior devil. After the book was published, interesting to me that Lewis was congratulated on his understanding of human psychology and wondered where he had done his research and how he had achieved such brilliant insight into the way in which the mind of man works. And Lewis is somewhat self-deprecating, a humble man in many ways, but he said, I hadn't done any research on that subject. I simply had a very available source of information about how temptation works. All I had to do was look inside myself and see it happening all the time.
Exactly. He knew what it was to be tempted.
He understood the problem of sin from personal experience, really, on a daily basis.
The examination of the problem of sin will be back next week. Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.